99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. It is now 5 p.m.
Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Thanks so much for tuning in here today. It's Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. Since we last spoke a week ago, the state budget was indeed finalized a bit late. We've been talking about the state budget negotiations, key issues to watch, and so forth for a lot of the last several weeks here on the show. Dominating a lot of New York political conversation, of course, over the last month or so. So much at stake in what wound up being a $220 billion state budget with a lot of policy decisions also in the mix, along with the funding decisions and a lot of really important elements there. But also, of course, since we spoke to seismic events in New York and in New York politics and government occurring yesterday, April 12th, sort of unfolding at about the same time in the morning, where there was this horrific shooting on the subway in Brooklyn, and then news breaking that the lieutenant governor, Brian Benjamin, was being charged with federal corruption crimes. He wound up turning himself in, then appearing in court, and by the end of the day had resigned as lieutenant governor. And we saw yesterday so much unfolding around the reaction to both of these events, and we are digging in on both of them here today, as well as some discussion of that new state budget. So here today on the show, in just a moment, conversation with Bob Hart, who I love having on. He's the New York political director of Spectrum News, which includes New York One. Bob has been in the news business in New York for almost 30 years. He is just very sharp and knowledgeable, and always like to have him on to break down important events. So in just a minute, Bob Hart will join me to discuss the fallout of the subway shooting and the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, which will have a significant impact on Governor Kathy Hochul's fortunes moving forward. We don't know what kind of impact exactly, but there's an election coming up very quickly. The primaries are in June, the general election in the fall, and a lot to dissect there. Then stay tuned in the second half of the show today. A large portion of the conversation I recorded just earlier today with state senators Julia Salazar and Jabari Brisport. They are both progressive socialists from Brooklyn, talking about these major events and then also getting into a whole bunch about the new state budget that they were, of course, involved with and voted on. They each voted no on several of the budget bills, and we get into that, things they're happy with, things they're unhappy with, and much more coming up in just a little bit with state senators Julia Salazar and Jabari Brisport, both of Brooklyn. Senator Brisport actually was on the scene of the subway shooting a little while after it happened. The station is at right at the edge of his district, at one of the edges of his Brooklyn district. So we'll talk with both of them about that incident, about the lieutenant governor's resignation, about the new state budget, and about the legislative session that's about to begin over the next less than two months, where legislators will be looking at a whole bunch of things that didn't make it into the state budget and perhaps passing some legislation on some major topics that were not resolved in the state budget. But first, Bob Hart, the New York political director of Spectrum News, which includes New York One, to discuss these major events that happened yesterday.
So let's start with the shooting in the subway. How do you put this in perspective for people? And that's as you noted, you're roughly 30 years in the news business, exactly why, you know, I enjoy talking to you, period, but also want to have this conversation with you about these two big events, because they both Of course, we've seen things like them both before. How do you think about events like this in the subway? This is not, we haven't been talking about things like this when we've been talking about the increase in subway crime, the increase in violence in the city, both above ground and below ground. You know, we haven't been talking about these major incidents that are, there's different definitions of terrorism, but like terrorism or terrorism, events like this seem to happen, every few years in some way, shape, or form. It almost feels impossible to completely prevent them. But at the same time, there's so many discussions happening around how to enhance public safety and how to do it with the right balance. How do you sort of put this in perspective of the debates that are ongoing and also the sort of longer term trends of subway safety in the city?
Well, I'm a student of history, and New York City has a lot of bad history, and that comforts me. It actually comforts me because you always hear someone like saying, oh, it's never happened before. This is crazy. No, it has happened before. It doesn't mean that it's good, but it means that we've got through it before and we can get through it again. The pandemic, obviously, we had the Spanish flu a little more than 100 years ago. It was horrific for the city. We got through it. The city had someone named the Mad Bomber, George Mattatsky, who terrorized in New York City primarily in the 1950s for 5 years, setting off bombs all across the city. He was a disgruntled Con Ed employee, and he was caught. And it was very scary. And like the newspapers were involved in trying to figure out who he was. More recently, when I was working, we had Edward Leary, the subway bomber in 1994, who set off basically it was like napalm, his version of napalm, on a train in Lower Manhattan, and 40 people were injured roughly, and that was really bad. Obviously, we've had other incidents, Bernhard Goetz, which is a little bit different, subway vigilante. Mm-hmm. So I use those things to sort of process things, and try to comfort myself and realize like the world isn't going to hell in a handbasket. Maybe it's already been there. We've been able to come back. So it is interesting, though, Ben, if you look, like, we've had like crazy people. And as we're speaking, there's just a suspect. Right? They haven't caught anyone yet. But there does seem to be a tradition in New York where out of towners get really riled up about something going on in New York City and decide to come to New York City and like shoot cops. Mm-hmm. Or Colin Ferguson, the Long Island Railroad shooter, he was from New York. But it is interesting how New York is sometimes a magnet or more like a flame for crazy moths who come in. And that's sort of how I view this. This, to me, in some ways is less, this is horrific crime, but it's not like, oh, that's a bad street corner and there's been four shootings there and the cops aren't doing anything. Like, don't get me wrong, this the kinds of things can't happen, but this has unfortunately been a part of New York City's history where people are coming and doing awful things. In terms of Lieutenant Governor, you and I mean, we both covered a million, not a million, but it seems like a million, so many of these guys, right? And they're almost all guys who got greedy or tried to get their campaign coffers bigger and then got caught. And that's sort of what it looks like, at least allegedly, what Brian Benjamin's been charged with.
Right. It's almost this reaction. I mean, we'll come back to the subway in a minute, but it's almost this reaction of here we go again.
Right.
But the speed here, obviously this is ongoing from when Brian Benjamin was a state senator and related to his city controller campaign. And then he was elevated to lieutenant governor, but the speed of his downfall is nearly unmatched here in terms of becoming lieutenant governor and then resigning. But Governor Hochul knew at least some of what was going on around questions swirling around Brian Benjamin's campaign donations and the potential that there was a straw donor scheme. And some, there were also questions that are not even part of this indictment about how he spent campaign money on a wedding party, potentially. I remember during his city controller campaign, he was on New York One with Errol Lewis, and Errol was really pushing him on using campaign money for this wedding party. Was it really a wedding party? How is he justifying it? And he did not look good there. I interviewed him. I asked him about this straw donor issue, and he did not seem to have great answers about sort of how his campaign was doing compliance. There were red flags here. What do you make of Governor Hochul's decision here and the fallout for her?
Yeah, I agree with you that she can't just say, she will eventually say, hey, I was lied to. He lied to the FBI. She'll say something like that. But the bottom line, like you just pointed out, is there's, if not red flags, there are plenty of yellow flags that might make you say, hey, is there another politician from Harlem who I can make my lieutenant governor? And obviously the answer is yes. And I think she just thought, oh, this stuff will blow over. There's plenty of people who have questionable donations. But I really think it was a lack of judgment by her that listen, I'll ignore these stories. This is just inside chatter. Well, guess what? A U.S. attorney went through and started digging deep. And I think, you know, to your other point about, oh, this happened so quickly. I think it happened quickly because the U.S. attorney's office didn't want to wait until after the election until it happened. I think they wanted, out of fairness, they probably accelerated this as quick as they could. You know, sometimes we've seen them take long times and we think an investigation's over, and it's not. In this case, I think this the U.S. attorney for the Southern District decided we got to rip this bandaid off now because it's not fair to the voters.
I want to come back to the how much of a liability this is for Governor Hochul now as she tries to win a first term as governor in this election. Lieutenant governor and governor on separate primary ballot lines, and then the winners of the nominations for each party join as a ticket for the general election. But I do want to note, you know, reading the indictment, there's some stuff that looks really bad in there. And then there's some stuff that, you know, we've seen cases in recent years with how the Supreme Court ruled a number of years ago about, you know, sort of making it tougher for prosecutors to, you know, to prove that a government action was taken on behalf of a donor. It has to really be, you know, very black and white. And we saw this seemingly help Mayor Bill de Blasio avoid charges and others. I'm not sure reading that this is necessarily a slam dunk case. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not giving a legal interpretation, just as a layperson, as a journalist. I don't know what you make of that. But there's some stuff in there that also looks really bad, like that that Brian Benjamin seemed to be very knowingly participating in the straw donor scheme. So,
yeah, I think that's a fair take in terms of it's dangerous when you want to predict the outcomes of trials. I've been all over the map on it. I mean, it's like I'm good usually at predicting the Super Bowl. I'm not always good at predicting the political corruption cases. Yeah. I think this is one where the prosecutors can win. That's my gut. But to your really good point about Bill de Blasio, a defense attorney could have said, if de Blasio had been charged, he'd been charged with no crimes whatsoever. We have to make that clear.
Yes.
That, hey, Bill de Blasio didn't personally profit from anything. And they can say the same thing here, that Brian Benjamin didn't make a dime out of this alleged scheme. And so that is helpful to him. On the other hand, I have covered, I remember former city councilman Sheldon Loeffler went to prison on similar circumstances for creating a straw donor scheme, and the campaign finance board nabbed him. And that's the other thing, by the way, if you're going to be an elected official who wants to game a system, don't try the campaign finance board. They have they have an army of auditors.
Yes.
So I'd recommend go somewhere else, like on a state level, maybe the federal level. I don't know about the federal level, probably not. But I think you're right. Like we shouldn't convict the guy. He's going to have his day in court. And we've seen plenty of people get acquitted. That being said, I think your note about personal involvement could definitely possibly sway a jury, because you're seeing him. It's not like his treasurer, it's him.
Right.
But, you know, we'll have to wait and see. We've seen people get exonerated on these kinds of cases. And like you said, the Supreme Court.
Right. And there's multiple charges. It could be, you know, there could be all sorts of ways this goes. There's also, obviously, it seems like the real estate developer who is in the mix here, who is doing the straw donors, you know, may or may not be cooperating. So there'll be a lot to come there. In terms of Governor Hochul's political liability here, this looks terrible for her. As you said, it casts questions about her judgment in picking him. There's been rumors and a little bit of reporting that he wasn't necessarily her first choice, that she might have wanted Ruben Diaz Jr. to do it, but he declined. Regardless, she wound up with Brian Benjamin. It does question her judgment to at least some degree. And now this comes, as you said, it might have been sped up so that it didn't happen after the election, but it comes so close to the primary election that it's going to be very difficult to get him off the ballot, although my guess is they find a way. But how much political liability do you see here for Governor Hochul?
Well, I could make the attack ad, which is, you know, you didn't know. You said you didn't know. Okay. And then you were the lieutenant for Andrew Cuomo, who two reports said was like a sexual harasser and stealing taxpayer money, or all but stealing taxpayer money by having people write a memoir for you. And you're out of the loop. So the ad would be something like, you know, Kathy's out of the loop. You know, do you want to have an out of the loop governor? So that's not a winning argument for her. The good news is, I don't know how much like people are really focused on the lieutenant governor. They're more focused on like, can they wear a mask or not on the subway, and their kids wearing masks, and what's going on with the economy and getting back to work. And people are really looking at the pocketbook issues. So I think it's a political hit on her, but it's not like a fatal one. I don't think she's mortally wounded. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she has to point to stuff. I mean, don't be surprised if you see her like in the governor's office ordering drinks to go, right. going to a Bills preseason game in August, that kind of stuff. Anything to get the talk away from Brian Benjamin. But she's going to have a debate where this will come up. There'll be, and I think this gives some ammunition to the Republicans in the fall as well, that, hey, you were looking the other way when Andrew Cuomo was harassing people and Brian Benjamin was stealing taxpayers' money. I'm not saying, I'm just saying I can just see the ads.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, no, I mean, I think you hit on a good point, which is it probably continues to be the case that Governor Hochul remains a strong favorite in the primary, but as far as I'm concerned, and we can talk about this down the line, but let me know your quick thoughts on it. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, there continues to be, a pretty significant chance that a Republican can win this gubernatorial race, even with the daunting voter registration imbalance, the fact that a Republican hasn't won statewide in 20 years. If it's going to happen, this might be the year, and it might be that gubernatorial office.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because you've had like two governors resign in scandals, a prostitution scandal and the sexual harassment scandal. You know, Eric Schneiderman, the attorney general, resigned. All these scandals over the last like 15 or 20 years, and it hasn't really put a dent on the party. I think 2 years of the pandemic, a governor who hasn't actually been elected to be governor. Like, yeah, I would put a giant asterisk on this year. And I think you're right. Despite all the numbers, like this could be a year where, you know, bad things happen to the Democrats in New York State. I still think the Republicans have to do everything right. And they have done a lot of things wrong politically over the last 20 years. So I would still favor them. But I totally agree with you. It's like, you know, when you talk about bad weather in a football game, like it's snowing, anything can happen. It's snowing right now politically, and that's sort of how I feel. What could happen this fall is like, you know, suddenly Aaron Rodgers in a driving rainstorm isn't Aaron Rodgers. Maybe you get the same thing with the Democrats in November.
Bob, you're making so many football analogies. I have to get your take on this. Part of what will be at play here in the election is the Buffalo Bills stadium deal as part of the state budget. Again, the way that Governor Hochul handled this seems to be providing ammunition for both her primary opponents, Tom Suozzi, the congressman representing Long Island, parts of Long Island, parts of Queens, public advocate Jemani Williams, and then, of course, general election opponents. Although sometimes you get people who sort of mostly acknowledge that they kind of are fine with the deal, but they don't like the process. How do you sort of foresee the bill situation helping or hurting her? It obviously helps her with her base in Western New York.
Yeah. And I, first of all, have to be upfront, full confession, I'm a huge Buffalo Bills fan. Yeah. That being said, it's like deal would never have happened downstate, like for the Yankees and the Mets. Like local lawmakers would have killed it, I think. And it's good for her that Buffalo's hundreds of miles away from New York City. I think if the primary opponents were really, really robust and you know, they're there, but I'm talking about neck and neck in the polls, this could be a real issue with Democratic downstate voters. I think it plays very differently in the general election. This is a huge win for her, I think, upstate, as particularly in Western New York. And I think that they balance that out, and they can argue correctly that lots of other states and cities have subsidized stadiums before, but not to this level, a side note. But I think actually it does politically benefit her. I know, you know, it's funny. I was wearing a Buffalo Bills sweatshirt the other day when I was at a children's party for our kid, for the kids in the New York Aquarium. And a couple people actually came up to me to talk to me about the stadium deal. Uh-huh. So it's really not popular, I'd say, with a certain swath of voters downstate. But I think they knew that going into it. And I think they did. I think they made the right political calculations on it.
End of the day, as you were sort of getting at earlier, there aren't going to be too many anti-stadium deal one issue voters, right?
Right.
I mean, people who might not like it, they're still voting on things related to COVID policies, the economy, and so forth.
Well, and also, it's liberal Democrats typically who say this is a handout to a giant company. Are they going to say in October, I'm not voting for right. Kathy Hochul, I'm voting for Lee Zeldin, or I'm staying home? Right. So I think that's what they thought, and I think they're probably right. But if this was a really tight primary, this would have been a huge mistake.
Well, and worth noting, it seems to be part of the reason that the governor worked into the budget about $350 million in flexible spending directly for Long Island.
Right.
By
the way, that's just like a carve out, right? Like, we don't even know where what that money is going to, right?
I mean, it's a slush fund. Yes. Yeah. It is, there's nicer ways to say it, but in essence, that's what it is. And it's to, both help Long Island state senators who want to keep their seats, Democratic ones, and help the governor there very clearly. And then also, though, you can obviously make the government case, hey, we're spending hundreds of millions of dollars in Buffalo on a stadium that's for economic development. Here's hundreds of millions of dollars right. on Long Island. And obviously, there's lots of money being spent in New York City, and away we go. Bob Hart, let's come back to, well, let me quickly ask you, the Lieutenant Governor, Brian Benjamin, former now, they're going to seemingly try to get him off the ballot in some way, get him to move into one of the states where his bail agreement allows him to move, maybe get him nominated for a different position somehow. As I said, if I had to guess right now, I think they find some way to do that. What's your sense of how Governor Hochul can or should handle a government replacement for him? She has to name a new lieutenant governor, we would think. Not has to, but we think she will. And then figure out this electoral landscape of trying to come through the primary herself and then have a running mate for the general election that she's happy with and she can run with.
Well, we've seen governors in the past, Kerry and Mario Cuomo, get lieutenant governors who they hadn't wanted. And it was like these uneasy marriages for both of their first terms. There's two ways that Kathy Hochul could play this. The one that I think the way she'll play it, I think, will be it's a political plum. I'm going to give it to maybe a Latino elected official or someone else. The problem with this, it has an expiration date. It goes away in January. Someone else is going to get elected because whoever she names will not be on the ballot most likely unless they come as a third party candidate. So it's a difficult needle to thread whoever she names. The other way she could do it is the way David Paterson did it when he was governor, and he was the first one to do it. He had to go to court to make sure he had the right to name his lieutenant governor because of the vacancy, is get like a Richard Ravitch type person, like a person who's been in government for decades, is well-respected, maybe in retirement, comes out. I was also thinking, what about Catherine Garcia, who's her top aide, former mayoral candidate? You slide her over, make her lieutenant. That would probably please a lot of editorial boards. Say, oh, I'm trying to clean things up. And then if you win in January, you can slide her back to her old job. First of all, I don't know if Catherine Garcia is interested in it. Right. But I do think she'll name someone. It makes sense to me. And I think either path is a win for her as long as she picks the right person with no scandals. Richard Ravitch was a real kind of feather in David Paterson's cap. You ran the MTA at one point. He helped bail out the city in the 70s from near bankruptcy. So I think she'll do something. And it's actually a significant pick, believe it or not, even though the job will only be for like 8 months.
Right. No, I think your first instinct there is where I would assume she's going to head, which is, but again, you asking someone to give up a current position for what could be a very short run.
Exactly.
Here. So I'm thinking, I haven't looked at who the possible names are or started to talk to sources on this, but I'm thinking, you know, sort of an elder statesperson of the Latino Hispanic community in New York City is probably where she winds up if she can get anybody, you know, to agree to it. And it'll be very interesting to see what they do about the ballot machinations and if there's some compromises that can be reached, or she starts to work with Diana Reyna, who's running as a running mate with Tom Suozzi in some way. You'd think Hochul wants to avoid Anna Maria Archila, who's running with Jumaane Williams, yeah. But we won't get into all those details. Let's just come back for a couple of minutes to the subway shooting. Mayor Eric Adams, in one of the most unbelievable twists of fate, is the you know, on the ground first responder mayor, and he's stuck in quarantine at Gracie Mansion when a major public safety event occurs in the city. How do you think, you know, what kind of challenge does this, other than the fact that he's in quarantine for a couple more days at least, but besides that, what kind of challenge does this pose to him and his agenda, both on public safety, getting people back on the subways, revitalizing the economy and so forth. It's all tied together. How are you seeing this right now?
Someone pointed out to me on social media how life sometimes imitates art, and that if you've seen the first taking of Pelham 123, not the second movie, which was horrible, but the first one, how the mayor is like sick with a cold, really bad cold in Gracie Mansion when the subway is taken over by terrorists. It's a terrific movie, not a great book, but a great, great movie. Uh-huh. And it's got to be driving the real mayor crazy that he's stuck in Gracie Mansion as this insane story is unfolding, and that the whole narrative of Eric Adams is that he can save us from the bad guys, and he can't even leave his house. I think he's done the best he can. You know, he's been doing these virtual interviews and virtual briefings to a degree. But it really is got to be extremely frustrating for him that since he's been in office for a little more than 100 days, there's been these incredible high profile crimes that only the least charitable person in the world would lay on his doorstep. Mm-hmm. But everything else is compromised if you're a mayor, if public safety isn't there.
And we have to leave it there with Bob Hart, the New York political director for Spectrum News, which includes New York One. There's a little bit more of the conversation. We're going to hear the full discussion with Bob about these seismic New York events of the Brooklyn subway shooting and the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin. You can find the full discussion at Max Politics, wherever you get your podcasts, or at the Gotham Gazette website. You are listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Always glad to get Bob's perspective on things. As he said, he's been in the local news business here for nearly three decades. He has a lot of really important long-term perspective on issues related to New York politics and government and really life in New York. And so some interesting thoughts there from Bob Hart on these major events that unfolded at about the same time, at least beginning to unfold early on Tuesday, and really important developments that have occurred, and a lot more to watch as we see how the mayor and the governor and others react to the subway shooting, and we see how the governor deals with the fallout of the resignation of her lieutenant governor and the upcoming elections, and there is a lot happening there. So we're going to continue to discuss both these events and much more with my next guests, who are two state senators from Brooklyn. They are progressives. They are socialists. They are part of the New York City contingent of the Democratic Socialists of America. There's about six socialists in the state legislature, and my two guests here are the two state senators in that mix, and that's state senators Jabari Brisport and Julia Salazar, both of Brooklyn, talking with them here, recorded a little bit earlier today on a number of issues, including the subway shooting, the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, and then getting into what I originally wanted to talk to them mostly about, which is the new state budget. They both voted no on several of the budget bills, and we'll get their explanation on that and much more. Here is my conversation with those state senators.
All right, let's bring on our guests here. State Senator Julia Salazar is the chair in the Senate of the Committee on Crime and Correction. She represents District 18 in Brooklyn. That includes neighborhoods of Bushwick, Cypress Hills, Greenpoint, and Williamsburg, parts of Bed-Stuy, Brownsville, and East New York. I'm also joined here today by State Senator Jabari Brisport, who chairs the Committee on Children and Families in the State Senate and represents District 25, also in Brooklyn. That includes neighborhoods of Fort Greene, Borm Hill, Red Hook, Bed-Stuy, Sunset Park, Gowanus, and Park Slope. Senators Brisport and Salazar, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks for having us, Ben.
So as I said, we're talking here on the day after this awful, tragic, horrific shooting in the subway in Brooklyn. We're talking the day after a very different kind of tragic event, which is the downfall of Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, who was charged with federal corruption crimes and then resigned his office yesterday. So we're speaking here on Wednesday, April 13th, 2022. So I want to get your reactions to both of those events of yesterday, and then, of course, talk about the recently passed state budget that you're both intimately involved with and what's coming up. Senator Brisport, the subway station where the shooting occurred in Brooklyn is right around the border of your district, and you went down to the scene. Obviously, people have been sort of glued to the news and know the gist of the details and what things look like. But any sort of other reactions from you from being at the scene and sort of how you're thinking about the aftermath of this and what, you know, your community and this Brooklyn community and the larger city needs coming out of this event?
Yeah, so this train station is part of my district in the Sunset Park section, and you know, this is still ongoing. The facts continue to unfold, and you know, I'm getting updates just like everyone else from the precincts and, you know, and the media, and I would say definitely, you know, I want to acknowledge that people are very scared right now, that, you know, that they're wondering, you know, how could this happen? You know, could it happen again? Could it happen again? And, you know, as a legislator, I always seek to, you know, think in terms of like prevention and how do we, you know, stop these things before they happen. I know there have been different calls. I know the mayor is, you know, calling to add additional police to the subway. I don't see how we can, you know, police our way out of this. You know, there were stories coming out of, you know, a police officer, you know, coming there and you know, saying his radio was broken and asking people to call 911. And then, you know, like, what's also, you know, the camera may be broken in that train station. So in terms of, you know, the priorities, it's like, what is the physical infrastructure we could use to bolster in our subways to make them both be more safe and feel more safe?
Mm-hmm. Senator Salazar, again, you know, as state legislators here, you know, very often this is obviously these types of, you know, immediate reactions are up to the executives and they're up to the, you know, the city and state departments and even federal. But as you sort of take this in, how do you think about ways to prevent things like this, ways in which legislators should or shouldn't react to events like this? This ties into safety on the subway, of course, but it's very different than the kinds of conversations we've been having lately. A lot of debates, you know, as we've seen some crimes increase in the subway and above ground. But it's obviously tied into how people are thinking about safety, feeling about safety. But how are you thinking about this?
I really, I mean, first of all, it was a terrible attack, really vicious, and it could have been pretty catastrophic and deadly. And thankfully it was not deadly, thanks to a lot of New Yorkers who were present, acting heroically, and MTA transit workers acting heroically to respond quickly. We, as of now, everyone who was physically impacted by the attack is expected to fully recover, which is really remarkable. And in the meantime, there were thousands of police officers in our subway system yesterday and yesterday morning when the attack happened. But obviously that wasn't successful in preventing the attack. And additionally, the person of interest in this case has not even been apprehended. We learned that the cameras in three different stations that were relevant in the attack, the camera system wasn't working, according to the mayor's office. That is really disconcerting. My initial thoughts are that we really need to make sure that our transit system is fully functioning, and make sure that that cameras in the system are operational. It's really disconcerting. Really makes you question, you know, if they're not operating in three stations where they check the cameras to see if they could investigate the attack through camera footage. The fact that they weren't even operating. It makes you wonder, you know, how, and how many stations are the cameras actually functional? And the other, you know, things that, that need to be functioning in the subway stations. I think it is relevant to public safety, given how many New Yorkers rely on public transit every day. So I'm really thinking about how we can make sure that the MTA is well resourced and address those issues first.
Beyond, you know, what New York City, New York State, the MTA, which is obviously a state authority, but works closely with the city and has, you know, a somewhat complicated governing structure. But whatever those decisions are made and efforts to make sure that infrastructure that's there is working, is enhanced and so forth. You know, we're obviously talking here about this larger atmosphere of fear, of you know, concerns about public safety generally, as I said, above ground, below ground. There's also lots of things, you know, in some ways being blown out of proportion in terms of, you know, how safe New York City overall is and isn't. Events like this obviously are, you know, going to sort of rock the city in a way that is very different than some of the other discussions that, that we've been having. Are there measures to take in the state legislature around, you know, public safety that you're thinking about? You're both progressive Democrats, socialist Democrats. You tend, as you both got at least a little bit, you know, to look at different answers for public safety than things like more police presence and so forth. Are there things just even before this incident that you've been working on, thinking about, that would create more public safety in New York City that you want to highlight for people listening? Senator Bridgeport, why don't we come back to you first? But when you've been looking at the public safety issues in the city, how are you thinking about creating a safer city in the more immediate term, right? When we hear from Mayor Eric Adams, we often hear him talk about sort of immediate intervention and medium to long term prevention, and that has to all go together. And a lot of times, you know, he's sort of challenging people who are on the left of him, like yourselves, about, well, what do you want to do sort of immediately to stem these problems? What do you say about that?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, after Governor Hochul released her 10-point plan for public safety, the BPHA caucus in the state legislature released a counter 10-point plan for public safety, which included a variety of points in the immediate, medium, long-term. Immediate ones being, you know, investing into more diversionary programs for people who are, you know, awaiting trial. More medium-term things like, well, actually, this could be considered immediate, but getting more money directly into programs for Cure Violence and SNUG programs to get more credible messengers and mentorship on the streets. And then also, you know, investing in our youth, you know, more medium solutions like after school programs, jobs programs for our youth.
Mm-hmm. Senator Salazar, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that we need to expand violence interruption programs, investing in youth programs, and that could mean sports programs, making sure that there are community centers and public places where young people can spend time and that are edifying for them. We really need to improve mental health services and access to quality mental health care in communities like those that Senator Brisport and I represent, and also other parts of the state where we've seen a loss of mental health beds and just a loss of really comprehensive mental health services. You know, these are all things that we know are directly related to public safety, but we didn't see the same emphasis or even nearly the same emphasis on addressing public safety through those mechanisms in this state budget as we saw on making changes to the bail law, discovery reform, and even raise the age.
So we'll come back to the state budget in just a minute. But as I said in the introduction, also happening yesterday, Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin indicted on federal corruption charges related to using his office to provide a state grant to a donor who he was involved with, allegedly, on a straw donor scheme and some other issues, and then looking to sort of cover up the relationship and some of the things that are alleged, again, in the indictment. We will see how this plays out in the courts. After turning himself in to these charges, the lieutenant governor resigned. The governor announced in the afternoon that she had accepted his resignation. So I want to get each of your reactions. This is obviously a terrible, apparent alleged breach of the public trust. It's also, again, a very sad story about, someone who's widely respected and liked in Brian Benjamin, who has two young kids. I mean, this is a very, sad story in a lot of ways. Senator Salazar, when this wasn't a surprise, right? Because there were stories about investigations. There had been issues around this straw donor possibility to his controller campaign last year. This was all sort of in the atmosphere. But anytime, a lawmaker is then charged with these types of crimes, it's a big jolt. Your reaction and again, on this, any ways in which you think about how it ties to, legislative duties and what you're trying to do in state government?
Yeah, I think it's certainly relevant to the need for ethics reform at the state level in New York. Right now, our ethics body is JCO, and a lot of people, I think, rightfully criticize JCO, which has largely been considered something for the governor to use to either escape accountability or protect people who the governor, has a political relationship with. There were efforts in the state budget to change the public ethics system in New York State, but in my opinion, it really fell short. In that, I don't think it's creating a truly independent ethics body that would be able to hopefully prevent incidents like what we are seeing right now with the lieutenant governor. So I think it was a missed opportunity, but we have additional opportunities and we just have to continue to advocate and work as legislators to try to actually bring independence to this new ethics body and make sure that all elected officials are actually held accountable.
We'll come to you in a second, Senator Brisport, but Senator Salazar, one of the issues at play here was discretionary grants, right? Basically the opportunity, and we've seen this come up in a variety of ways before, the opportunity for legislators to direct grants to nonprofits that they want them to go to, right? Lots of very valuable work gets funded this way, but we also see ways in which, these types of discretionary actions. And again, he had to go through a process. It wasn't just, State Senator Brian Benjamin could, write a check, although that happens sometimes, more or less through certain government offices. But is there anything that this highlights for you in terms of the way that process works in your experience? Are there problems with that, or is it actually, it's kind of good for legislators to be able to help direct money in their districts? They just, people have to do it ethically, and there have to be good ethics watchdogs. Anything sort of highlighted that's wrong with the system in your view from this?
I do think of it more as the latter, that it is generally a good thing for legislators who know our districts well on a hyper local level, know the needs of our communities, to be able to direct funding where it is needed most. However, we need account, like true accountability and enforcement when there is a conflict of interest or suspicion or even the appearance of corruption or the misuse of funds, like, you know, what is alleged in this case with the lieutenant governor from the time when he was a state senator. But I think generally, it's good for us to have discretionary funds. On the other hand, I think that legislators have an obligation. We should always have an obligation to be as specific as possible, in terms of how public funds are being used. And that's something that, that also came up in this budget process as we're reviewing in the final hours, budget bills and just getting the language hours before voting, and seeing certain items in the budget that sort of resemble slush funds or, you know, are not sufficiently detailed, when it comes to spending public money.
Senator Brisbois, your reactions to to former state senator and Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin resigning and the issues at play.
Yeah, I mean, I would echo some things my colleague, you know, Senator Salazar said, just the need for J-COPE reform and a truly independent body. It's definitely disappointing. I do want to continue to watch how it plays out. You know, I just spent three weeks arguing with moderates and conservatives about over bail rollbacks and, you know, the notion of innocent until proven guilty. And, you know, I don't want to presume guilt in this case, but it is actually, it's very disappointing. And, you know, when things like these happen, it not only looks bad for Brian Benjamin specifically, but it casts a shadow over the entire legislature. You know, the people who government is corrupt feel vindicated by this. And then, you know, just regarding our in district money, I do believe in, you know, building more transparent processes. You know, just want to echo what Senator Salazar said, that the governor snuck in a, you know, $350 million slush fund into the budget at the last moment. It is important that, you know, everyday New York. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. It is important that the public knows, like, how money is spent and where it goes. You know, I have constituents all the time, they don't understand how money comes from Albany. They were like, my former senator gave me this, the woman gave me this, Albany gave me this, the Brooklyn gave me this. And I'm like, what do you mean Brooklyn gave you this? So I think there's a lot of confusion over it. In general, it needs to be more transparent.
Well, on that front, one at least partial positive in the state budget deal is something of what's called a database of deals of the government being more transparent about economic development deals. Obviously, that came as this Long Island, as you say, slush fund was being approved, as well as the Buffalo Bills Stadium subsidy. So some of these things, obviously trade-offs of sorts that come together in these big packages that, as you said, often are not anywhere near fully reviewed before they're voted through. All right, there's so much more to discuss there, but let's talk about the state budget and the upcoming legislative session that's about to start. And it's going to be very brief because it is also happening concurrently with this election cycle. So let's at least start with each of you with sort of one big positive from the state budget and one thing you're really, you know, disappointed on. And if you need to sneak in a second on either front, you know, take your privilege in that front. But Senator Salazar, a $220 billion budget, so much in terms of funding, lots of policy. We're not going to get to it all. But what do you want to highlight for New Yorkers, something you're proud of, you're happy about, and something that you're frustrated by? Go ahead.
Yeah, some of the things that I am proud of in this budget are also at the same time inadequate from our perspective. One of those is we were really fighting for fair pay for home care to robustly increase the minimum wages for home care workers across the state who really are paid poverty wages in general. And we did see where we were able to secure, thanks to the leadership of the legislature, was not in the executive budget any, you know, pay increases. There were bonuses for home care workers included in the executive budget, but It was actually through the advocacy of both houses of the legislature that we were able to secure permanent minimum wage pay increases for home care workers. I really feel that we need to increase wages for home care workers much more substantially. We'll see a $3 minimum wage, $3 an hour minimum wage increase for home care workers over the next 2 years as a result of the budget. And while that is great, I think we're really going to need to see a much bigger investment in our home care workforce in the immediate future in order to meet the demands of what is really becoming a long-term care and home care crisis in New York.
As is the case, I think, for both of you on a number of fronts, that's you know, something that you're pleased to see, but not going quite as far as you want, Senator Bridgeport. I don't know if this is what you want to choose, but you've obviously been very focused on childcare in your tenure. As I mentioned, you chair the Children and Families Committee. Is that the one you want to highlight, or you want to speak about that and then something else? Go ahead.
Sure. Way to lock me in, Ben. But,
no. Go elsewhere. We can come back to childcare.
Well, let me give a quick shout out to the Transgender and Gender Nonconforming Wellness and Equity Fund, which is just it's a dedicated fund for what it sounds like. And, you know, speaking as, you know, one of the openly queer legislators in the state legislature, that, you know, that means a lot, not just to me, but also to the community. Childcare is, to be honest, bittersweet. It is definitely a historic investment, although the bar was low for how much money we invest into childcare. It definitely, you know, was great to see, you know, so many see the influence of, you know, the Universal Childcare Act and the Universal Childcare Campaign that we've been doing over the past several months to a year in terms of raising raising the income threshold, raising reimbursement levels to localities, you know, fighting for school-age children. But, you know, also sad things to see, such as, you know, excluding undocumented children, not actually meeting the desperate need of a sector that's really in free fall. And also, I think not having an accurate model, to be honest, you know, in negotiations with the governor, I think she assumed that the participation rate would be much lower than I'm expecting it to be. And I'm very worried that we will be telling people that they are not eligible for childcare and they will find that there is actually no money for them to get childcare.
So, yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. When you explain to people what got done here, how do you capture sort of what's going to become available that wasn't, or what this really accomplishes in terms of an expansion of childcare in New York? I was sort of expecting when the governor held her press conference announcing an agreement with the legislature that she was going to kind of lead with childcare because it was such a big issue, something she's focused on, something she obviously cares about. But she didn't. And there were reasons, obviously, for her to talk about middle class tax cuts and the gas holiday and some of these other things that obviously apply to a wide constituency, but also clearly constituencies that the governor is very concerned about it as she seeks election. But it doesn't seem like, I mean, how big of an expansion of childcare are we talking here? Can we help people understand the sort of the degree that you're saying, even if it isn't going to help capture everybody who may need it and want it? How big of an expansion are we talking here?
Sure. The sector is heavily means tested with a lot of jargon, but in terms of eligibility for parents, we've raised the subsidized income threshold from 200% of the federal poverty level to 300%, which in more plain language means that previously, if you were a three-family household, like two parents, one kid, you would qualify for subsidized childcare if your total household income was around $45,000 or less. And if you made more, you'd kind of be on your own. And now, under this program, a three-family household, if you in total make $69,000, around there, you will qualify for subsidized childcare.
And we have to leave it there with New York State Senators Julia Salazar and Jabari Brisport, both Brooklyn Democrats and members of the Democratic Socialists of America, New York City chapter, the two state senators of the DSA that are part of a six-member state and legislative socialist caucus of sorts. Some interesting thoughts there from Senators Brisport and Salazar about the Brooklyn subway shooting, about the resignation of Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin, and about the recently passed state budget, including some of the budget bills where they both voted no, and some of the reasons why. There's a bunch more to the conversation. If you want to hear the full discussion with State Senators Brisport and Salazar, you can find it at Max Politics, wherever you get your podcasts, or at the Gotham Gazette website. We got into a whole bunch more. You are listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Earlier in the hour, you heard from Bob Hart, the political director for New York for Spectrum News, including New York One, and a portion of my conversation there with State Senators Brisport and Salazar. Thanks very much for listening. We will talk with you soon. I'm Ben Max from Gotham Gazette. Be safe and take care.
$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
I'm Max Schmid, staff representative to the WBAI local station board, letting you know that the next meeting of the LSB is on Wednesday, April 13th at 7 p.m. Please join us. We expect a report on activities of the new, recently seated Pacifica National Board. That's the LSB meeting Wednesday, April 13th at 7 p.m. The meeting, accessible to the public, includes an opportunity for public comment. It will be held through the Zoom remote meeting service. The quickest and easiest way to join the meeting is by using the link on the Pacifica calendar at kpftx.org or on the WBAI website. You can also access the meeting by calling 929-205-6099. Once again, 929-205-6099. And enter this meeting ID, 922-457-2995. The meeting ID again, 922-457-2995. And the password is 995, like WBAI's frequency, so it's 995.995.99. And I hope to see you there.